Is it okay to make a joke these days? So many podcasts I've had to make, people ask me to delete it. You know, I talk to them, they open up, they cry, whatever the fuck, and I'm trying to be me. And then they want it gone because, you know, they're nervous or something. I don't know. I get it. You know, there's so much fear of judgment out there. And, you know, it's a metaphoric death in a sense. It could be a literal death. It could be an evolutionary realization that if we do not say the right thing to the right people, they could hit us on the head with a rock. Well, that's what this podcast is about. Fearless expression of fucked up humor, as well as some deep realizations from working with children in some of the most horrible conditions you can imagine. So it's a very interesting podcast that can go anywhere. Either the meaning of music, what makes things funny, how do you help someone that's in the darkest moments of their life? So, don't know how to explain this, but that is what's going to be in this podcast. But how would you encapsulate your story or what you're currently doing?
Oh, that's a broad question, isn't it? I mean, I don't know where to go with that one. Well, let's see. I'll uncover yours. It's insurance advisory firm. I've got myself and another insurance advisor, and we go around and try to bore as many people as we possibly can by talking to them about insurance, giving them policies. And then, obviously, I'm not a Kiwi. I've been here 15 years, though. The company's been around for 10. Don't know. What else do you want to know?
Yeah, I threw you under the bus there. I'll help you. Don't worry.
I appreciate that, Ryan. Thank you very much.
Your backdrop just looks so much better than mine, so I was jealous and I had to lash out. That's all it is.
But yours looks very comfortable.
My bed's there, literally, and my workout gear's there. So I'm all about it. I just work 7 days a week. This is all I do.
I remember the days. There's something nice about that.
Yeah, well, I've also done the work 8 weeks in 4 years and do whatever I wanted and realize that's awful. This is actually fun. People say, oh, work-life balance. I'm like, oh, well, your work sucks. That's what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You just got to find something. What is it they say? You find something you love doing and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I have a mental break, so I take myself to the beach and then it cures all ailments.
Yeah, swimming. I live beside the beach, so I'm not. To be fair, I might live beside the beach, but I'm not a fan of the beach.
What are you a fan of? What brings joy to your world, mate? What do you do for fun?
Oh, what do I do for fun? Music, principally. I love music. Big fan of music. I like playing at a few bands. Organise gigs as well locally. So organize whatever gigs I can. Do a bit of stand-up comedy. That's fun. Organize those things. Spend a bit of time with family, kicking about. My kids are now a little bit older, so they can't look after themselves. So whenever they want to come in and speak to me, I'm happy to speak to them. Happy to spend what time I can. And spend time with the wife, beginning to relax and watch a bit of telly, pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Wow. Try to avoid any sports that involve physical exercise. Because I feel I'm getting a bit too old for that. But that's it.
Wow. Yeah, comedy. I would have projected that onto you. Potentially, this is where I say tell a joke, but I'm just kidding. How long are you down for?
Well, you can say tell a joke, and I'll just say something along the lines of, do you ask, if you meet an orthopedic surgeon, do you ask them to perform surgery?
Gynecologist, I would.
Oh yeah, that's true. And who would you offer up?
Joel, you just assume my gender. You've been cancelled. That's
that's true.
Ah, sorry. I was trying to think of what a boy one was, but I couldn't work it out. And you know how they do the prostate? I could have gone that route, but is that just a GP or is there a specialist prostator?
I imagine I don't know. Who does rectal exams? We could Google it and find out, I suppose.
Yeah.
Proctologist, is that not what they're called?
That would be impressive. Do you think that they should division of labor it, so you just have one finger person and the other one note-taking? Just
well, you would hope that there would be a left hand for one and a right hand for the other.
Good lesson. You
would, the nurse picking up the sheets, or the person, well, now it'd be typing, wouldn't it? You wouldn't
one-handed, typing.
Yeah, you really wouldn't want to have a... I suppose that's why they use gloves. They can take the glove off afterwards.
You know the most useful innovation would be the new Apple goggles. So then they wouldn't even need notes or hand hygiene. Just be like, have you seen them? Those big things where you just virtual reality and you can still, or something reality, some kind of reality where you can fuck with it, but it's still real.
Like a connected reality kind of thing.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
What's your take on that? Are the machines taking over?
Could they do an any worse job than we already doing? I think it's a question.
True.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there was always that sci-fi thing, wasn't there, where you would be the person where humans would just sit around and relax, enjoy life, while robots looked after our every need. They'd done all the jobs, but we all received like a Star Trek. Oh dear. That'll get you cancelled. Confusing Star Wars and Star Trek. That's instant cancel. But Star Trek Utopia, where you just do what you want to do. There's no money needed.
Horrific. Yeah. That sounds awful. Like, people say they want it till they do it. I promise you, I've been there, done that. It's horrific. You need to have some sort of... Jordan Peterson was saying happiness is having a goal, working towards a goal.
Yeah.
What's your take? Because you've got a background in counselling. What do you think, we can be happy, or what's the point of life?
Well, I think we can. If there's a point in life, there's another broad. Well, Nietzsche said, I think we can be happy. We can be content in what we're doing. It's just what you want to look for, isn't it? They say that if you earn $70,000 a year, I'm sure I read somewhere that $70,000 was kind of like, once you go above that, then the money doesn't matter as much as the quality of the job and the work environment. And they say that the young generation are all about the worker, well, younger than me. There's three generations as far as I'm concerned. There's people older than me and my mates and kids. That's pretty much it. But they say that the younger generation are kind of... they're looking for more than just the paycheck. They want something back. They want to feel good and content with what they do. So I don't know. Maybe there is maybe there is happiness and contentment and just sitting around saying, no, this is good for the moment. Being present. This is good at the moment. I don't know. Maybe I'm just talking shite.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I think I used to rub old people's feet, and it relates to what we're talking about. And just to sell them like thousands of dollars worth of medical equipment. That did help, but it was a door knock, and now I'm rubbing their feet and we don't know each other. And I used to ask them what's important about life and why. And they always said the same thing, which was some form of connection, some form of purpose, and some form of independence. So not feeling constricted with money or with health.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah, would you add anything in your list? What's your contentment list?
Oh, I'd be quite happy with a guitar and some peace and quiet now and again.
Should you plug your name? Are you on Facebook or anything with your music?
No, I'm not. I've been in a couple of bands, a few releases and stuff like that, but nothing that I'm particularly keen to share.
Fair. So you're sitting in the shower or at gig sort of vibe, huh?
Yeah, well, singing, I just like to write music, write original stuff. And, and whenever I've been recorded, I've played the bass rather than the guitar. And you'll find very few recordings of me actually singing. There's one or two of them out there, but not very many. I have to dig hard.
Yeah, well, we might be able to. YouTube, it always carries something from 10 years ago. There's me pissing off a tree, I think. 2007.
You see, now that's why I'm glad that I'm the age I am, because there was no ubiquitous video cameras and photograph equipment when I was being young and doing daft things.
Yeah, good point. Well, I mean, like, I climbed the tree. It was a really high tree. And I needed to go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom on the tree. And then I had to climb down again. I didn't think about it.
Yeah, well, you got to do it. When nature calls, you've got to answer. You can't, it's not good for you to do anything else. And if there's somebody you don't like under the tree, adds even more to it.
True. And I was helping global warming because they take CO2 from the atmosphere. So I was just helping giving it nutrients.
That's it. A little bit of nitrogen to help it along the way. Yeah.
World's fastest Indian, you know, he was a big believer in lemon trees, peeing on that. So if I could probably drive a motorbike pretty good.
Yeah. Is that where that came from? That's one thing that I've heard since coming over here. Peeing a lemon tree, it's good for the lemon tree. Was it Bert that started that? Was it?
I think he was told the lie as well. I think, I mean, it makes sense. I don't know why. Mum's a gardener, ask her. She just tells me to dig stuff, and I dig it.
Yeah. So do what you're told. Do what your mum tells you is probably the best way forward.
It's given me authority issues, but I'll listen to her. I remember I read my preschool report card, which was really deep, apparently. And I was like, Ryan will play with the other kids, but he likes to make his own rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, that's why I don't work for people. So
that's good advice.
Great advice. So music, I'd be curious, how do you think about writing a song? Like, why does when I make songs, they don't sound like they should be sung? You know what I mean? Like, I can write poems.
Well, that's the exact same. That's all a song is. It's just a poem, isn't it? Only with a melody.
Hmm. What is melody? How do you inject melody? Could you sing anything?
I suppose you probably could. Yeah. Well, you see the auto-tune people on YouTube, don't you? Trump singing along to. So yeah, with the power of auto-tune and a decent recording studio, you could probably get anybody singing anything at all. Throw in a little bit of AI, deep faking, you could have
South Park. Cartman slaps. I don't know if you've ever come across the AI. He's him singing like death metal. That's fucked. Remarkable.
Yeah. So you could get off famous people from the past. Abraham Lincoln singing along to Slipknot would be an interesting combination.
Gosh, I don't want to start giving ideas here. But yeah, do you ever think of how to either put yourself in the mental space to write or how to construct words in a way that they have melody?
Oh no! What I do is I start off with the guitar, so I'll play around until I find a couple of chords that sound good together and get a nice wee rhythm going on it, and then just build it from there. And if I remember to record it, then it will stick in my mind. And if I forget it, forget to record it, then I'll have forgotten it by the next day. But I'd sit down, play a couple of chords, get them going, get a bit of rhythm, and then you can just build words around it that fit that rhythm. It depends whether I want to write it as a death metal song or whether I want to write it as a country song. Change is appropriate. Change the lyrics as appropriate. Or don't. Make it even more fun.
Interesting. Do you think, is it like a resonance with chords? Because I've seen animals dance to music and there's also some. My emotional state can change dependent on the music and also the associated words.
Yeah.
What do you think that is? Like, what do you think determines whether a song is an emotion or is it person to person?
I think it's probably person to person or mood to mood even. But if you put on a certain beat, you can get a whole room dancing to it just with the bass. So you dance to the beat. And I think maybe the melody and the lyrics can give you emotion. I think it was Steve Earle. I don't know if you know who Steve Earle is, but he's definitely worth a Google if you're into your folky rock. But Steve Earle, he said that his songs, along with Bruce Springsteen and all these other people, these songs were like 3-minute stories that you can listen to in the car. And and all his songs are you know, they're about things. They're about his political views, or they're about his kids, or they're about his girlfriend, or a fictitious situation, things that he's seen, because he's a bit southern, so about the mining communities that he grew up in. Or so he writes lots of different things. It's like Bruce Springsteen, as I say, or John Mellencamp, or all these people. They tell stories, and those stories evoke an emotion in you. So that's one part of it. And see, the beat just gets you moving, doesn't it? I mean, if you could be sitting in a nightclub and the music comes on, it's like, boom, and all of a sudden you're tapping your foot. Even if you don't like the song, your foot's still tapping, and you go, damn it, taught me again. So, yeah. But if it doesn't evoke, if it doesn't give you an emotional response, you probably won't listen to it.
What do you think on the beat side? Is it some correlation to the heart? Do you think it's an evolutionary thing that helps us retain information if we sing as a collective, or it might be us pulling together? Like, why do you think music is such a pivotal part of life? It's just an easy question.
You're slowly throwing these huge, big, massive questions at me. I don't know. I couldn't answer that. But even if you think about it, if you look at religious songs, for example, you go into a church and it's hypnotic, isn't it? They say that the Catholic Church kept it in Latin, even though people never spoke Latin, in order to because it was the hypnotic sound, and the big cardboard ceilings of the churches was to give you that hypnotic sound of everybody just saying the same things and repeating it back over, and puts you in a trance state, makes you feel relaxed and at one with the bigger group. I suppose it's similar to I don't know, not religious at all, but even like the Muslims, and when they're all doing their prayers at the same time, it's that bonding together and saying the same things over, and that feeling of oneness. Maybe it's the exact same in a nightclub. It's everybody's just dancing and feeling the beat, and that closeness and bringing together. Maybe, I don't know. I'd say, could we just be talking shite?
Do you think about like set structure, like in terms of like you're about to play, and you think about how you start at what you do in the middle and what you do at the end, and
what of a song or of a set?
A set, yeah, a set.
Yeah, it's like a group of songs. Oh yeah, absolutely. You plan it out so that you can. You plan it out so that the vocalist can have a break. You can't have the vocalist screaming at the top of their lungs or singing consistently. These long solos at the end of songs like "Sweet Home Alabama" and "Hotel California," these huge, big, long solos were apparently put in there to give the vocalists a break, so that they could rest their voice, because they used to do 3 or 4 sets in a day, so they'd just give them a nice long break. So the story goes. So yeah, you structure your set. You don't go. It's like a meeting, you know. It's like anything. You structure what you want to say and how you want to say it. Because you want to end on a positive. You want to end on a song that everybody kind of knows, or everyone can bounce along to. You want to. If you've got an hour and a half set, you might want to slow it down a little bit in the middle to give the people in the audience a little bit of a break. I used to be in a Foo Fighters tribute, and we'd all slow down the middle bit so that people could have a little break and a little breather. Because you can't go hard out for an hour, but you can. But I'm getting old, so I can. Yeah, you definitely structure the set. It's like everything, you structure it. If you're going with a plan, yeah, a good chance of it working.
It's interesting. I mean, I was listening. Taylor Swift walked past this artist and said something like, "Really love that hook in this song." And I think about that from a content standpoint. Is you basic structure is hook, retain them, and then reward them for the journey they went on, which is basically what you said for a set, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's the same idea of a concept album, you know, like the old Pink Floyd and the progressive rock groups that wrote albums that were all one story, one song. Pink Floyd's The Wall would be a perfect, well-known example of that. You know, it's kind of a theme that's carried throughout the whole or like musicals, I suppose. I'm not a fan of musicals at all. I can't really give an example. Jeff Wayne's War of the World might be a better one. That's the same. It's an hour and a half song. It's the same themes that go through it. It tells us, tells a whole story over an hour and a half as opposed to 3 minutes.
It's crazy, like, because I was thinking a lot about stories, because basically all I do for a living is make videos and make calls. And yeah. One of the best producers, well, best influencers in the world is Mr. Beast. He gets, you know, tens of billions of views every month, and we've got billion-dollar companies. And he talked about just studying Pixar and films, and so I asked AI to do it for me because I'm lazy.
Yeah.
And then it found consistent themes throughout the different storylines. So Toy Story was feeling forgotten. Inside Out, the complexity of emotions and not being able to, you know, keep hold of them. And I wonder that as well in music, like, is there a universal emotional appeal or theme within it, whether it's vying for a father's love or nothing you do is ever good enough, or facing adversity and it seems improbable, but you find a way. Do you ever think about the theme of your music?
Oh, I think so. When you come to write a song, you kind of, I suppose when I put, because I start with the music, I start with the guitar and then build the music up from the chord. It's like, how does that make me feel? I suppose if there's lots of minors in it, it can make you feel quite one way. If there's lots of majors in it, it might make you feel happier. But yeah, you saw, how does that make me feel? Oh, right, okay, I'll build words around that. And yeah, that's kind of, so I suppose there is a universal, I mean, all, there's only so many stories that humanity tells, and that's been the case from, if you look at ancient Greece, I'm sure if you ran the same AI thing with the ancient stories of Greece, whether it be Plato or Aesop or whatever, they'll have the same kind of themes. Shakespeare, the same kind of themes, you know, love, loss, comedy, humour. We've lost love, back together again, anger, stabbings, murder, mayhem. They're all the same. It's like, you know, it's a love story or a, I don't know. Lots of different types of stories, but always kind of, we don't tend to diversify much from that, because there only is so many feelings that I suppose that are, you, all feelings are universal. So if you can evoke that feeling in somebody, then it's going to have universal appeal, or at least an appeal to a large number, which is why I suppose, I don't know, maybe that's why the likes of Hollywood are so focused on remaking old films that were really good and making them worse. I don't know. Maybe they should focus on some of the stories, that the really good stories that were really terribly made, and give them life rather than picking a really good a good story that was well made and then kind of ruining it.
Yeah, I can sense some frustration. I can't remember his name, Ruben Rubio or something like that. He's the guy that would like help Jay-Z and these different artists write these amazing songs. He's got big fuck off beard and long hair. And he was saying, what goes wrong in the creative process for like movies or for art or for songs is the moment they try to make it for others.
Yeah. Rick Rubin. Is that who you're thinking of? Yeah, Def Jam Records, I think, is his record label. Yeah, he'd done everyone from Slayer to Danzig to, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. You write it for yourself and you get an attachment to it yourself. And somebody else will buy it. Just like you, what you're doing. You're making content. The people who watch it will be people that relate to your, to what you produce. And if you're producing it from your heart, be authentic. Is that not one of the call signs of the 2020s? Be authentic and you'll attract your tribe. Ah, probably true.
Massively. It also pisses off people not in it.
Well, you see, you know, if you're pissing people off, you're doing something right.
Well, actually, I like haters more than people pleasers, because haters, one of two things, either they're right and I need to fix it, or they're wounded or delusional. So either way, I learn or I'm empathetic to that poor bugger that's projecting all over me, you know?
That's fair enough. So, probably a good philosophy to go through life with.
Yeah, it's chill. Yeah. Sometimes I get butt hurt. There was a video where I peed myself a little bit and I did a speech and I was like, fuck it, I'll do the speech anyways. And then I posted the content and then some guy copy-pasted on like 6 videos. How can I respect anything you say when you peed yourself? And like copy-paste. And I was like, oh, that sucks. And I wet the bed till I was 21. Not that you needed to know that, but that adds a whole lot of potential trauma onto the statement that they shared. How do you deal with hate, mate? What's your, if you built this beautiful music and you're about to share it with others and they judge you, how do you deal with it?
I don't care. I get thick skin. I've been told many, many things in my life. I don't care. I really don't care. Sometimes it's worthwhile winding people up. You know, if somebody gives you a bit of hate, sometimes it's just nice to just encourage them. Flame that hatred. See exactly how apoplectic you can get them. I think it's called trolling.
Jeez. You probably had the odd heckler. What's one of the best heckles you've got?
I've never had that many. I've never had that many heckles, to be honest. Yeah, people will shout stuff out. But when you're on the stage and you're doing comedy, you've got a light in your face. So you can't really see anything past the first row. And when people shout things out, you can't really hear them. They've got to be really clear and concise. And so a lot of the time it's just not worth responding to it. And a heckler doesn't tend to want to be nasty or spoil the show. They just want to be part of it. They want to help you. They want to, in general, they just want to be part of it. They don't tend to be, they're not being nasty. They don't want to spoil it. They just maybe a little bit pissed and a little bit overzealous, and they just want to, they just want to be part of what's going on. So I don't think they mean anything bad in general. That's maybe deep. I'll be a bit naive, but we'll see.
So they just want to be a part of it. That's deep. So on in terms of humor, because I've been sort of thinking about what actually is funny. And I find I put on a bit of a character in the podcast where I don't let loose on either going deep. Like if this wasn't recorded, I'd probably understand, you know, the deep recesses of your mind or the aspects of your childhood that shape the way you are today. And maybe you'll cry and then you'll delete the podcast or I'll say fucked up jokes. So both of those, we're not quite there yet on the podcast. We'll get there. But how do you become more funny, or how have you developed your craft, or what do you think about when trying to construct something that's funny?
One thing I've noticed is everyone seems to have different processes, and some people like to write everything down and structure it. I just tend to like find something that I find absurd or that makes me angry or that makes me laugh or something. It can be anything at all. It could be the way somebody drives in front of me, it could be the age I'm at, it could be something I see online, anything at all. And but as long as if it gives me an emotion, then I can riff on it, and then I'll kind of think about what's absurd about that or what's stupid about that, and then juxtapose something. Try and juxtapose something that's reality with something that's stupid, that's just so far out of there that it causes a bit of cognitive dissonance, so that it jars you out of your, what? That's just stupid. It's a bit of a skill and it takes a bit of time. And I think the trick to it is you try it and you'll fail at it, but you'll pick one or two things up and then you'll twist it around a little bit and you'll try it again, and you'll probably fail at it again, but you'll get a little bit better and then you'll try it again. And eventually, once you've tried it a few times, you begin to understand what it is about it that's funny or what it is that's really not funny, and you just may as well bin it and not go back to it. There's nothing worse than thinking, I've got something really good, and you see it, and the place is silent. And then you might try it again the next a couple of days later, a couple of weeks later, and the place laughs, and you say, all right, so it's not the joke that's the problem, it's the crowd weren't that age group, or they weren't thinking that way, or I didn't land it right. I better said the wrong thing. So I don't know. It's there's not. I'm one of these people. I just talk until it comes funny, and I'll repeat it again and again and again, and and eventually it'll come funny. There's people who just write it and it's absolutely spot on. It's a little tweaking, but I'm more of a talker than a writer when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Interesting. I think there's something really beautiful and valuable about art, as well as, you know, I would put comedy as art or music and those sort of things, because it's the way it's eloquently telling the harshness of the world.
Yeah.
You know, because if you directly say some combative or harsh things without some elegance or some absurdity, it doesn't land quite the way. And they're thinking it, but they're afraid to do it. But you do it in a socially acceptable way.
Yeah, you can come out unhinged and outraged very easily if you don't get it right. You know, if the people with the white jackets waiting for you, or people with pitchforks, one of the two. But it's, yeah, I mean, but I think it very much depends who you are. I mean, if you're like Ricky Gervais, you can pretty much say what you want and get away with it, because people expect you to do that, and they're looking to be shocked, and, you know, people watch them so that they can get offended and send them tweets about how offended they are, because, I don't know, they were born yesterday or something. But yeah, it's different when you're just playing to 50 people, 80 people in Wellington or wherever. It's very different, because if you say something that is cancelable, you can very quickly turn a room off, and the person who's put it on might go, no, you're not coming back. Or worse, the person who comes on after you, because you only get a small 10-minute bit, the person who comes on after you, you might have offended them. You could say something sexist and a woman comes on after you and just eviscerates you for the first 5 minutes.
Oh, God.
And rightly so. And you just sit there going, oh, no. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, it's like...
The worst part is it can still objectively be funny, but the delivery was wrong. You know, like, you're still hilarious, but you weren't backing yourself and you just half-hearted it, and then you just get decimated by the next person.
I mean, I've seen people say homophobic things and it's just not hit with the crowd, and the next person's come on and just slaughtered them for it, and you're like, well, you probably deserved that, to be fair. So, you know, and there's some things that you're just, that are never, you can see people trying. Open mics is one of them. Open mics, that's where you'll see comedians really maybe make a bit of a faux pas. But there is a reasonably safe environment, because the gen tends to be comedians telling jokes in front of comedians with only a few people. But there are comedians out there who deliberately go to cause offence and to wind people up, and that's fine if you're, as I say, if you're one of these big celebrities and you're playing in front of 1,000 people at the Michael Fowler Centre or whatever, or you're playing one of the big arenas in London, that's all fantastic, offend away. But if you're playing in front of 20 people in a small pub in Palmerston North,
you just shouted out my hometown, mate. Used to clean the plaza, sweep the floors 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. Interesting. Yeah.
So what's your sort of comedy then? Who are your favorite comedians?
Oh, who do I like? I like Bill Burr, Jimmy Carr.
He's good.
People that are just messed up. Russell Brand, like, I don't think he's that funny, but I like him as a person.
Yeah.
Tim Dillon. I've been going all over him lately.
I don't know. I don't know his stuff.
Yeah, he's a gay guy in America that's like, hates everything. And he just like talks shit. But then he also talks about the life, how life really is, and like the military industrial complex and all that sort of stuff. But does it funny, so people listen.
Yeah.
And then next he'll just call up the real estate agent and pretend he's buying a house, but not. He used to get a semblance of the man, he used to be a subprime mortgage salesman. So subprime, which caused the global financial crisis for people that don't know. And he doesn't care. He's just... But anyways, so what was your either first ever, like, oh my God, I'm going to give this a whirl, or what was your worst ever bomb?
I think the worst ever bomb was actually one of the ones that also was quite a big hit. I've got kind of a bit that I do about the Loch Ness Monster and there being a monster in the Loch Ness area ever since the Earl of Inverness was named Prince Andrew. And being known locally as the Loch Ness Nonser. And liking his woman like he likes his whiskey. 15 years old. and full of coke. And, yeah, so he laughed at it, but some people get quite upset by that one. So, yeah, that can hit or miss. I've had a lot of grief from that and also a lot of laughs, but you don't know until you see it what people are going to do about it. But see, now I've burned one of my jokes.
Yeah, gee, yeah, you can't use it. You got to write originals now. Got to start.
I tend to try and put a new 10-minute original set together every month or so.
Wow, impressive.
Because you go down. It's all right if you're doing. I'm in Kapiti, based in Kapiti, so I've got a gig in Kapiti on Saturday. So I'll go out, I'll do 10 minutes there. But I had a gig in Kapiti on Saturday in December. So I can't really, and it's going to be roughly the same crowd because it's a small town. So you can't really say the same thing. So you've got to kind of write a new 10 minutes.
Wow.
So it's fine down in Wellington, I can see, because there's different crowds all the time. You go to different bars, different crowds. So I'm going down in Wellington on Friday night, and I'll test my Saturday one. But I could use a tried and tested set, and it would be all new people, because you get that mixture, that rotation of punters. But in Kapiti Theatre, I'm likely to, half of that crowd has probably been there for the one previously because it was a couple of months ago. So got to be original. You don't want people going, I've heard that, or calling out the punchline before you get to it.
That'd be horrible. Jeez.
This is not a concert where you sing along.
Yeah, no, you don't want that. Gosh.
No.
Going back to what you vaguely bring up, Epstein, did you see the Stephen Hawking memes when they found out he was on the list?
I found out he was.
Oh, remarkable. It was just, do you think there's Illuminati? Is Epstein part of the CIA? Did he kill himself? What do you think?
I don't know. There's so much bullshit out there, isn't there? I mean, it's like, what do you do? But if the stories are correct and he had a video camera in all these bedrooms and was supplying the nonces, the powerful nonces of the world with underage girls and drugs, a sneaking suspicion that he could probably pretty much do what he wanted and his back would be covered because it's like, I'll send this file to the newspaper maybe. I don't know. I don't know. The idea of there being one group of people that control the world, I'm not entirely sure, because the idea of that sort of level of psychopath being able to work collaboratively with a number of people doesn't sit with me. I can imagine I think there's a group of people that can influence the world, or they can influence small areas of it, but they'll do it for their own benefits, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I've met hyper successful people, and they're not that remarkable. Like, like they've done consistently focused on one thing long enough for a longer period of time. But I think they're as much a part of the Matrix as they create it.
So, yeah.
You know what I mean? But there's definitely, you know, there's definitely influences of, hey, we pay this politician $12 million, like this part of the department, $12 million a year. And they seem to make these sort of policies that service our best interest. Well, you know, that's some level of influence.
Yeah, I think at the same time, there's also the soft power. If you look at the, if you look at politicians, for example, that, you know, they decide to do a fundraiser. So they charge $1,000 a ticket, and all the supporters of that party pay $1,000 ticket. They go along, then they have an auction of all the things that fundraise funds, and they've got a politician sitting at the table. There's very few people who can afford or would want to pay $1,000 for a ticket to sit next to their local MP or somebody who's and get the selfie with them. There's not many people that are prepared to do that or could afford to do that. So therefore, their opinions are shaped by who they hang around with. What is it they say, that you're an average of the 10 people you see most? So if you're in that group of if you're sitting at a table with 9 other people at an expensive dinner, and those 9 people are telling you how terrible it is for landlords or business owners, or how, you know, this group of people are abusing the system, that's what you're going to hear, that's what you're going to pick up, and that's possibly how you're going to react and what you're going to write policy about, because these are now your mates and you've got a bit of an affinity with them. You've broken bread and shared some wine, so you might write policies that are more towards them, rather than going down to the local WINS office and sitting down and having a chat with them, bringing in a morning tea and sitting in the WINS office and chatting to the people who are actually on the benefits. They might get a different opinion if they were to do that, and they might write policies for different people. So yeah, while those like giving the cash, it's who they mix with, I think, and who they court. As a business owner, if I go to the local Chamber of Commerce, I'll guarantee you that the local MP will be sitting there and the local mayor will be in there. And so they're talking to the business owners, the local council, they go to the old folks home. All of a sudden, there's more stuff for old folks to do. You know, it's just the way it works, I suppose. You know, maybe not.
Yeah, you had those caveats at the end.
Yeah, you've got to caveat everything.
Potentially,
if I claim to know everything, then I could be a priest or something.
That's true. Yeah, no, well said. So, there'd be, in terms of hanging around interesting people, I think off air we talked about you had a life prior to being an advisor that was around very colourful people.
Yeah, done a few things. Yeah,
we'll pick one. What genre should we go down?
Oh, I don't know. Well, you mentioned prostate exams, and I used to be a okay. used to be a pharmaceutical sales rep, and
oh, good. Marketing. Convincing doctors to kill people—is that what it was? Or
well, yeah, we went and convinced them to give more drugs to people. Yeah, that was it. It's like, come on, I need my bonus. Can you? I always find it strange because you watch these kind of American dramatizations of what the pharmaceutical industry is like, and I'm like, that's not what it was like in the UK, and it's not what it was like in New Zealand. It was nothing like that at all. You were so heavily handcuffed in what you said and how you could say it and how you evidence. Yeah, you talk about, there was a company that gave out, obviously they did a drug for prostate, and they gave out these little like stress ball dice things. Well, it's like a little cube, and at the hole in the sides of the cube, so that the doctors could put their fingers in there to see what different size of prostate would feel like, so he could tell whether or not, you know, it's like, oh, it's this size, give them this dose. If it's this size, give them this dose. It's this size, possibly send them to the oncologist.
So you got doctors fingering a toy.
Yeah, I was like, well, I just remember seeing that sitting there once in a staff room going, what is that? And the doctor explained, and I was like, that's it's an interesting device to leave behind. Yeah.
So you sold the first ever fleshlight.
Well, that wasn't me, I have to say. No, it wasn't that was me. That was somebody else. But yes, if fleshlights had existed then, I'm sure there was a there was probably somebody going, yeah, there's a market in that.
Gosh, there must be a better way to know. Like, why do fingers need to get involved?
I don't think anymore. I think they do a blood test now. I'm not of the age where I need to get checked regularly, but I believe some of my older friends, they say they just do a blood test, and if your numbers are high, then they do the digital exam.
Wow. So if you say no homo, it's fine, eh?
Sorry?
If you say no homo just before they put the fingers in, it's fine. Eh? Like, I'll still go to heaven.
is that the rules, is it?
Don't know. I'll ask God. I'm not religious, but you got to hedge your bets.
Well, I don't know. Having read the Bible from cover to cover, I have to say there's some highly suspicious shit in there.
Yeah. I like the one where the guy gets called names by the kids. Like, oh, hey, bald guy. Hey, bald guy. So he prays and then sends down a bear to slaughter the 10 children.
Yeah, that's it. Justice. That's pretty brutal.
Any hater, I'm going to pray every day.
pray hard for a bear to appear out of nowhere.
It's their fault, though. Like, if 10 kids can't get away from a bear, like, for like, you know what I mean? Like, at least two get away.
You'd have thought 9 of them would have been fast enough to make it.
Like, it rinsed 3 of them quickly, but like 7 easily. Like, throw one down, slow it down. You know how like polar bears, when they come at you, you take off clothes and they smell it and slows them down? I don't know if it's true. Yeah.
I don't know.
Do it with kids. Just throw the kids down.
Yeah. It's like that episode of The Walking Dead where the guy running away with the guy running away and turns around and he shoots the other one so he falls down and gets eaten by the zombies. I think that was season 2 or something when it was good. and he runs away and I think it was Shane or something, one of the characters runs away and leaves the guy down there to be eaten so he could escape. Yeah. That's it, yeah.
That's humans, yeah.
Put your child, throw it behind you so the shark gets that while you swim off back to the ship.
God, shark, like, just you trying to throw it would make it too late, you know what I mean? Like, you're mid-throw. Yeah. And everyone thinks you saved it. No, you're just trying to save it. You're just trying to get it. Yeah. Anyways, that's charming. Yeah. So yeah. You did something else as well as pharmaceutical stuff. You involved consoling people with unhappiness.
I worked with I worked with children and 12 to 18 year olds that were, some of them were young offenders and seasoned truanters and all sorts of stuff. That was quite, thought the idea of saving the world one child at a time.
Yeah.
In my naivety.
Yeah, what is it? Is it hard to save them? Like, because I know parenting is a huge part of shaping identity and then the environment. And even though you're doing the best you can, they're in an environment of unsafety. So what was your experience with what's possible to help them?
I think a lot of kids, to be fair, and most kids are good, genuinely nice people. You know, sometimes their situation can be a bit crap and bad family life, or it's just, I don't know, there's lots of things can go wrong that can cause them trauma. And I think the other part of it is you've got kids that have like dyslexia or they've got learning difficulties and they go through school, been called stupid and daft, so they truant out, and by the time you actually pick up the learning difficulty, it's too late, because not too late for them, but it's very difficult then to instill the ability to read and write and count and all that stuff that they've missed in those years. And so each child is different, and you know, most of them were really good kids and they just needed somebody to listen to them and chat with them and treat them as an individual and as a human being, as opposed to a horrible wee kid. And yeah, some of them had done horrendous stuff and, you know, some of them needed real help. But for many of them, you know, they just needed somebody to talk to and somebody to sit down and chat out their problems with and spend a little bit of time and encourage them. And some of them were absolutely genius, you know, some of them were really, really smart. You know, if they could, you know, if you can take the four tires off of a car quicker than a Formula One pit crew, that's some skill. You know, there's ones out there that could do it. You know, but they could, you know, kids that could rebuild engines and stuff, but they weren't very good at sitting reading and writing for hours in school. So, you know, the school system just kicked them out or treated, or, you know, pushed them to marginalise them as opposed to encourage them. But that was, yeah, I don't know, I think the school system over here is a lot different than the school system in the 1980s and 90s or 1990s, back in Scotland when I was doing that stuff. So, you know, maybe education's changed. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I sort of see education as a tree, like the photo, I see a tree and then you've got a dolphin, you've got a monkey and you've got a whale and then you've got a snail and they're all told to climb it.
Yeah.
But what do you think, what was one of the worst things you heard in terms of a child having to go through or a suffering they inflicted on someone else?
Oh, if you can imagine the worst, then yeah, that's there. But, you know, it's not something that I don't think we should really be talking about it. But yeah, if you can imagine the worst situation that could have happened to them, that will have happened to kids I've worked with. And if you can imagine some of the worst things that you could do, yeah, some of them will have done that. But it wasn't all of them. It was just a, you know, small minority. It was a big school I worked in with, I think it was the biggest in the UK for that. So there was always kids, but yeah, some of it was pretty horrendous. And it gets to the point where it's like, well, you know what, that's pretty horrendous, but that's pretty horrendous, and that's pretty horrendous. How horrendous do you want to be? You know, there's a level where everything after that is just shocking and horrible. And, you know, you can think, how could you possibly do that? And then other ones you think, how could you possibly not be in a worse state than you're already in, having lived through that? So yeah, it's pretty nasty stuff. But yeah, I don't think it's too good to talk about it, because it's kind of like it's kind of like disaster porn kind of stuff. It's like, how gross can you get? And there's that film, I spat on the kitchen table and I thought I'd won the gross out competition until he brought out a straw. So you can always go one worse, and there always is one worse.
Sure.
Well,
just on that, in terms of how do you maintain empathy for those that have inflicted horrors, and also how do you distance empathy for those experiencing so much and you carry it home with you?
I think that would be the best way to do it. You kind of, before you go into these situations, you check yourself. It's like, well, how am I feeling? So you got to understand how you're feeling before you go into these situations. Much like a sales call, probably before you do a podcast. It's like, how am I feeling? Right, okay, well, I'm this sort of way. Cool, I'm going to play to that. And if you're in a situation where you know that you're going to be angry, or you think it's, you go, okay. But when you're in there chatting to them, you've got to separate what they've done from who they are. You can't define them by that action. You've got to see them as a human, and that's part of their humanity, that's part of their story. And if you're going to deal with that, then deal with that. You've got to be cognizant of it, but it shouldn't define who that person is. And you know, yeah, you take it, you do it, you hear these things, you read these files, and you go, holy shit, that's pretty horrendous. But you can't, like, you don't dwell on it. You know, there's a lot of people that seen a lot worse and have to deal with a lot worse than I ever did, you know, whether it be soldiers who are seeing their mates killed, or whether it's ambulance paramedics that are scraping people up off the floor and things like that. So there's lots of horror things that, and you know, you just learn to disassociate. You learn to go, okay, well, that's that. that's what it is. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of worse things could have happened, could have seen, could have been in the world. But yeah, you just learn to not be. And you also sit and talk to your colleagues. Lots of black humour, let's say. It's a really, really dark humour. There's lots of that. So you just kind of keep yourself dissociated from it, and you just don't get the person tied up with the crime. Don't get me wrong, there was one or two like real nasty people who were probably psychopaths and things. But at the same time, there was lots of kids who were really quite nice and just there was a lot more that were nice kids that were just a little bit off the path. And, they just needed a little bit of guidance, a little bit of understanding and a bit of a good role model. Maybe if you could try to do that, then yeah, it could work. It worked quite well. You won a lot and you lost a few, but it's just the way life is.
So what would you if there was the young person listening now that seems like insurmountable, the odds that they're facing, and there doesn't seem to be much hope because of the environment that they're in, what would you say to them?
I'd say find someone to talk to. Find someone you trust, you know, whether it be a teacher, whether it be a care worker, whether it be a mate's parent, where it's just got to, you've got to talk about it and say, I need help, and be strong enough and brave enough to ask for help, I think. I'm sure there's assistance out there. I don't really know the New Zealand system at all well. I've never had to deal with it. But I'm sure there's assistance out there for them, and it's about asking for help. And, you know, if the teachers are, if people are treating them as, you know, if the system is treating them as a problem, say, well, I need help. If you help me, then I'll do it. But, yeah, I think reaching out and asking for help, because it's not easy. And that's not an easy thing to do. And I don't for a second think it is, but I think it's asking for that assistance. It doesn't can be anything from anybody. It's finding a way to connect, and it's because it's different. There's so many horrible things can happen to kids, and so many horrible things are done to kids. So. And some horrendous experiences they've had. So it's really difficult to give one piece of advice that fits all. Here come the caveats again. But if you can find help, if you can find someone they trust and find someone they can talk to, make a relationship that's positive, then that would be a good place for them to start. And I think the teachers in the schools are probably much better than the teachers were in the schools 30 years ago. It's a tough question, that.
Yeah, well, it's a tough conclusion too, my friend. So so thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been great to have a chat. It's been good. Interesting conversation. how this comes out, how much shite I've been talking for the last hour.
It's a beautiful mess.